Hi, I'm Trevor Elio.
And I'm Julie Stern, and this is Conceptually Speaking, the show where we interview experts to uncover the concepts and patterns that help us organize our world.
From farming to fashion, we can understand any field through acquiring, connecting, and transferring conceptual relationships. We hope this podcast will inspire teachers and students to design creative solutions to complex problems and accelerate innovation in today's schools. If you're interested in our work, you can find out more at edtosavetheworld.com.
Our guest this week is Vince Bustamante, a social studies consultant and co-author of Great Teaching by Design and the Distance Learning Assessment Playbook. Vince is a member of our extended team and has been doing some great work helping his teachers move towards teaching for conceptual understanding and learning transfer in his hometown of Alberta, Canada. He's also been busy writing two stellar books meant to help teachers implement Dr. John Hattie's research in both in-person and distance environments. And he shares some great tips on important shifts we'll need to make to adjust to our new COVID reality. Vince's experience as both a classroom teacher and consultant helped him realize that there's some big gaps between the afterglow of a great PD session and successful implementation of what teachers learn. It's a gap he hopes to close by helping teachers focus explicitly on students and their learning.
We need to explicitly know what students' dispositions or unique dispositions and their past experiences, what they bring to the lesson, so we can implement those learning interventions with a level of fidelity. And it goes beyond the welcome to grade four or welcome to grade seven, please fill out this business letter about yourself and what did you do this summer. It goes into what are you learning or where are you coming from? What are the standards? What's the purpose of our learning? And in this, in Great Teaching by Design, we use Professor Hattie's skill, will, and thrill. So what is the skill, will, and thrill that students bring with them to the lesson? And so this whole model is based on being true to the student and being true to the standards and not getting wrapped up in the flavor of the week lesson that you could download from a website.
Vince's passion about assessment and implementation made him an equally informative and engaging guest. If ever there was a time for us to reflect on how we view assessment in our classroom, it's right now. So get ready for some great insight and enjoy the episode.
Our guest this week is Vince Bustamante, who is a curriculum consultant with Edmonton Catholic Schools and Corwin Press, as well as an author of Great Teaching by Design and the Assessment Playbook for Distance and Blended Learning. Welcome, Vince.
Thanks for having me. I'm really excited to be here. Very much have been looking forward to chatting with yourself and Julie. I'm quite a big fan of your guys' podcast and a big fan of all of the work that you have been doing and very excited for all of your upcoming projects.
We appreciate it, and we're really happy to have you. Very germane titles that you're kind of bringing up here. So could you kind of start by talking to us about your models for implementation and impact that you're exploring in these works?
Absolutely. So the first book that I had been working on, which is called Great Teaching by Design, revolves around Professor John Hattie's DIE model, the DIIE model, which we've affectionately called the Discovery Model. Mm-hmm. And essentially, the discovery model has four parts. It's the discovery process in which we would use various assessment strategies to get to know our learner before jumping into specific interventions. And I'll talk a little bit more about that later because I feel that's like a really important piece of mm-hmm. the model. Then from there, we would choose specific interventions according to their impact and according to what students require based on our discovery. Then we would move into implementation, and the last step in the discovery model is the evaluation of our impact. And so, the four-step model that we based Great Teaching by Design around is essentially purposed to be recycled more than one time a year. Mm-hmm. So the viewpoint is that the evaluation then pushes us into a new unit of discovery, and we would go kind of cyclically throughout the school year. Continually adjusting our instruction. And so the point is to really focus on the behind the scenes of teaching. So instead of figuring out what strategy or instead of just applying a strategy blindly, the teacher should take a little bit of time to learn about the strategy and how much potential it has. And the goal here is to actually get implementation happening from professional learning situations or books, or podcast you listen to or any great idea that pops into your head that needs to be that should be implemented needs to go through this model of implementation and evaluation.
Mm. Love that. And before we started recording, you shared sort of the why. So do you mind sharing with our listeners, why is this so important and what sort of problem are you seeking to solve?
Sure. So this all manifested in my personal experience with the work, the visible learning work, and my personal experiences with professional learning sessions. And one of the fortunate aspects of my role as a curriculum consultant is that I get to attend multiple professional learning sessions. I've been to quite a few of yours, Julie, mm-hmm. and lots of Corwin-based professional learning, as well as other mm-hmm. professional learning sessions, and hosting my own professional learning sessions right. within my division. And what was happening is at the end of the day, or, you know, there's like a 48-hour period where teachers come away from these sessions and they're just super fired up and they're mm-hmm. ready to implement whatever they learned, and everything that they listened to was the best thing they've ever heard, almost mm-hmm. like a flavor of the week. And then, mm-hmm. you know, Saturday, Sunday goes by, and on Monday they're back into the regular grind. Mm-hmm. And then all of the great learning that happened and all the great research that had been done for them and provided to them in a professional learning session kind of dissipates. And so it was kind of through my personal experiences that I wanted to leverage a model where we moved from this potential into actual implementation.
Mm-hmm. Love that. I mean, it's so key. And, you know, you're reminding me of something that we talk a lot about as a team, in that what we're trying to do in focusing on conceptual understanding and learning that transfers is difficult. It's complex. It's not easy. And sometimes, you know, I feel our quote unquote competition out there for professional learning, or what Trevor affectionately calls cotton candy PD, where it's just like low nutrition value, but like high sugar. And I love that analogy of just sort of like rah, rah, kind of show you this sappy video and everybody's crying. And, you know, it's like have relationships with the kids and you're like, yeah, duh. But you know, I love that the idea of implementation has been on my mind a lot over the last few years, because as you know, because Vince is on our extended team, I shared with you all recently that about 2 years ago, I was like, gosh, I just keep flying around the world and doing these presentations. And then I have no idea. Sometimes people will like send me an email or a tweet or something to say, hey, mm-hmm. Here's how I did, you know, what I did that to from your talk. So I started doing these long-term relationships with schools. I started going back to the same school multiple times over the year. And that really was enormous, I think, in just both just impact and job satisfaction, mm-hmm. Because you're building relationships with people, you're seeing the impact, you're seeing actual student work. And so I love that you guys, you know, this is always what John Hattie does. He takes things that are really hard and complex and makes them like a science, both an art and a science. And so we always ask, you did go through the whole model, but we always ask our guests to share three to five words. So if you don't mind, like what kind of anchors, you went through the model, but, and some of the words are similar, but mm-hmm. if you could share for our listeners, what are your three to five anchor words that you associate with implementation and impact?
Sure. So the five that I chose in no particular order, even mm-hmm. though they kind of link up and some of them flow cyclically, are discovery, implementation, fidelity, learner focused, and then the last assessment, and I put a slash, so assessment/evaluation. Mm-hmm. Those are the five. And as we've been having this conversation back and forth, I could probably place them in order if I needed to, but I don't mm-hmm. want to outweigh importance because they're all kind of equally important to
me. Well, I would love to start with learner focused, if that's okay with you. And you know, because you kind of alluded to that in the discovery piece when you were introducing the DIE model. Mm-hmm. So could you tell us why you chose that term is not in the DIE model, but you can sort of infer that it's there. But why did you choose that as one of your anchor concepts?
Yeah, so I chose learner focus as one of my anchor concepts, and it does sync. Actually, it's kind of embedded within that discovery section of the model. But I was finding as I was coaching more in my division, and this is not common, but it occurs every once in a while as you work with teachers, and you would know that as you in your role, that a lot of the concerns that teachers have are teacher concerns and not learner concerns. So I will use an example of time. Mm-hmm. And, you know, with this shift to COVID style teaching, whatever that looks like, wherever people are teaching from, time seems to be the most precious commodity. And it's always, I don't know if I have enough time to blank, or there's never enough time to blank. And I kind of was reflecting on that, and it led me to kind of consider, like, whose time are we talking about? Are we talking about teacher controlled time, or are we talking about learning time? And there's a big difference in there. And so I chose learner focused because the purpose of this model, even though it's called Great Teaching, the book itself, the purpose is to be learner focused. How are we impacting student learning? And what are my actions as a teacher that are focused on the student to lead them to success or to progress or growth, whatever measurement you want to use. And so that's the whole aspect of putting the learner first. And in the book, we kind of coined the term the who behind the do. So the who behind the learning is really important.
And I feel like that is such a big challenge as we transition to these distance environments too, because even teachers who previously were, you know, doing more didactic instruction where they had that time, it maybe wasn't paying the dividends that it could have if they had considered other approaches, but at least the function of the class was there. They at least had that feeling of satisfaction as they covered the material. But now removing that, I feel like that is causing a lot of teachers to sort of panic because they're realizing that some of those more didactic strategies don't translate as well to distance learning. And even personally, as somebody who does do everything they can to really center student time, I've been noticing my own economy of language, where there are times where maybe I would over-explain or talk about something that I would be bringing in. I'm having to focus on being more concise with my instructional time, so my students do have more of that. So could you talk about some of the things, some of the strategies or tips that you've been noticing that have been helpful for teachers to relinquish more of that time and center students' learning as opposed to maybe their instruction?
Yeah, and I'll even start by saying, as absolutely terrible as this shift, this COVID pandemic has been, I know Professor Hattie has been calling it the great educational experiment, because right now we've been given a little bit of freedom to determine what has been working and what will continue to work. And so there has been lessons learned from what we've been doing in COVID that we can carry forward when we move back into face-to-face or whatever seemingly normal situation is going to look like in a few months or in a few years. But the repurposing of time, I think, is such an interesting conversation to have. And that's how I explain it to teachers when they say, I don't have enough time. I kind of flip it and say, maybe don't think of it as like a transactional, like you're taking time now and you're never going to get that back. It's repurposing. And so some of the lessons from the distance learning experiment, we'll call it, would be taking students and making sure students are really explicitly taught routines and expectations up front, not as we're going along. And I kind of use the classroom rule metaphor. When you're face to face, generally, teachers on the first few days of school will go through classroom rules or classroom expectations, and then they just kind of live on the wall, right? If you put them up, they're on the wall, and every so often the teacher will like maybe like tap the whiteboard and say, you know, no talking when the teacher's talking. Well, that kind of falls short in distance learning, because we can mute the students, but that's a whole other situation that I don't want to get into. But students should know the expectations and should have a routine prior to engaging in something that may be more freedom based. Because a big concern that teachers have that I've been working with is allowing students to learn on their own. There's this aspect of I have the information and I need to remove it from my brain and put it in the student's brain. And the only way we can do that is if I'm talking. Right. And so it's no different than when I first started teaching. So when I first started teaching, I taught history IB, so high school history IB, and the students were like sponges. They just wanted me to just regurgitate, like just say everything I know, lecture to them 60 minutes. And I would ask them a question, but the question I would ask them is like a puffball question, right? It was like a lobbed up question. I knew someone knew the answer, and it was like just a quick check-in. And that was for me. That question was for me as a teacher to say, okay, I'm on the right track. You know, I kind of call it like a self high five. I give myself a self high five. They answer the question right. I move on. Right. learner-focused discovery aspects of assessment and instruction in this distance learning situation requires teachers to put some responsibility in the students' hands and get away from using face-to-face synchronous time as lecture time. Face-to-face synchronous time should be time where students are collaborating, where teachers are providing specific coaching and facilitation for small groups. And then asynchronously, depending on what your timetable looks like, but some school divisions only have 3 hours a day face-to-face with students. So on the time that we're not face-to-face, that's where students should be engaging in practicing and demonstrating. So I should record my lessons. If it's a 15-minute lecture, I should record that and then allow that time. So almost like a flipped approach. And there's so many benefits to recording. I mean, if you have an ELL student, they can slow it down and they can rewatch your lecture. You can't pause live teaching. And oftentimes, and Trevor, you know this, you're still in the classroom. If you get on a little bit of a, you know, I used to call it like, I would get on like this mode where I'd almost like black out. It's like, you know, when you run, when you're running,
the flow state,
you get to a point where you just don't feel like you're running anymore. It's all natural. Mm-hmm. Right. So then all of a sudden I'm teaching, I'm in this groove, and a student puts up their hand and I call them and they can you repeat what you said like 2 minutes ago? And my answer was always like, not exactly.
Or they're like, can I go to the bathroom?
Right. Exactly. So I've just been finding that if we're a little bit more explicit in the procedural aspects of our teaching and putting a little bit more onus on our students to be responsible for their learning in certain aspects, it can provide a different look at the use of time. Now, I know I made a lot of comments that could be loaded in that, like, you know, this idea that students may not do the work, right? That's a big concern. The idea of breakout rooms scares some teachers, right? I don't know what my students are doing in their breakout rooms. And I kind of answer that by saying, when you put students in group work in your classroom and they're in four different corners, you don't know what they're doing when you're not, you know. So it's no different. It's just taking the physical aspect out of there is daunting. Mm-hmm. And some teachers are still learning how to navigate that. And that's okay. I think this is a learning curve of unprecedented in unprecedented times. And so everyone's pivoting. And I told myself I wasn't going to use the word pivot because it's just like, I feel like
unprecedented pivots. Yes.
Yeah.
If I could maybe tie a thread through two of your last points that I feel like are really important, is sort of paradoxically this idea of establishing structures and routines that will then allow students the skill set, the habits of mind to use their autonomy effectively. Because I know that I have been on occasion have been really excited about an idea or concept and post questions to my students before really establishing those routines. And unfortunately, students have sort of been conditioned even in the pre-COVID era to be more receptacles for information and knowledge than generators and producers of it. Mm-hmm. And I will, you know, I'll scaffold and build this beautiful lesson and then pose this question. And before I had built those routines in, I'd have times where students were like, we didn't know what to do with that freedom. Mm-hmm. I was doing a Socratic seminar with seniors, and the first time I did it, even though they were like, we're really interested, we just don't really know how to handle this level of discussion and freedom. And it really made clear to me that putting that in the student's hand is great, but you have to build structures and routines first. And that's something that I feel like many teachers are starting to learn about. It's not just about providing the opportunity. It's also about, fostering those skills and those habits.
And, you know, it's funny, I use like a metaphor, like working out. So like, my wife and I are got back into it. The first few months of the pandemic were tough. And then we joined a fitness class that had instructors that gave us the workouts we needed to do, and then set us free to complete the workouts, obviously, supervised. But I think of that, like, if I were to just get a membership to a gym, and then just go kind of work out, it's not a good workout for me. I need that structure to push myself physically. And it's no different in classrooms. If we just give just time, just a blanket of time. So you guys have 20 minutes to study. as an example. Students need more structure and need more coaching through what that would look like to actually push their learning a little bit further. So it's so important for us to establish the parameters around learning. And one of the things that you mentioned, Trevor, that resonated with me was this idea of the concept, the conceptual question. And after going through, and I've been familiar with Julia and your team's work for like 2 or 3 years now. But it wasn't until I went through the Learning Transfer Certified course a few months ago that something just like the stars aligned for me in that I was like, oh yeah, okay. So I've done bits and pieces of the learning transfer work. And then all of a sudden, when I went through the whole process on my own, it changed some of the delivery of my PD in that teachers were asking that question, what do I do with time? And my subject matter expertise is social studies. So teachers in Alberta were asking, okay, I don't know what to do with these students. And there's so much stuff to cover in such little time. And I kind of designed this, you know, based on some of the work that you guys have done, I designed this, I call it from concepts to content lesson. And so face-to-face, we're exploring conceptual understanding together, and the teacher will coach students through understanding concepts. And then individually or asynchronously, students will then use their conceptual understanding to draw out similarities through social studies content. And then they're like, so instead of me spending, you know, let's see, I'll use 8th grade social studies as an example, because it's three very different case studies, but they study the Renaissance in Europe as a worldviews in interacting. And then they study the relationship between the Aztecs and the Spanish when the Spanish conquered Mexico. And then they study Japan. So three geographically very different case studies, but they have similar conceptual relationships in that how do two foreign people interact, or what are the results of new civilizations meeting ancient civilizations? And if we can draw that out, I don't need to spend 40 minutes explaining the Aztec Empire. I the students can access that information on their own. And so we're at this crossroads where Google is even closer to students than it was when we were face-to-face. They're literally on the machine that they can access Google. And so why not use that to our advantage? And I'm not saying that we shouldn't get students to not engage in surface level learning. I'm saying we should leverage the tools that they have in front of them so we can drive their understanding of concepts deeper. And so that's why we moved from this idea from content first learning concepts, which is kind of the old school model, to getting messy with conceptual understanding so that their content links are clear. And with some of the teachers that I've been working with, it's like, it's changed the way they've been teaching social studies. And they're like, we're just going to keep doing this face to face. Right. And so
love it. That's so great. I'm just sitting here pondering the concept of time. I mean, we need to, that is so interesting. And you're right. It's the number one thing. When my husband joined the Foreign Service, we moved to Sierra Leone in West Africa. And so I was just like, wow. I mean, you can't get quite as polar opposite of where I was working before and then where I was working then. And I was just like, no matter where you go in the world. And I was also consulting in Asia and Latin America. And no matter where you go in the world, teacher, the number one complaint or problem or dilemma or whatever that teachers bring to you, it's most common, is time. And wow, what I have learned about the concept of time is enormous. And so I love that you just gave that quick switch, which is, you know, we mentioned it in Tools for Teaching Conceptual Understanding, my very first book. Io Magwood was a 12th grade civics teacher who said she would link the concept to students' lives. Look, you know, authority, you know, abuse of power, you know, limited power, you know these things, you know, alliances, you know, enemies, you know, so many things in your lives as teenagers. And so she would link the Constitution to in the US to things going on in students' lives. And yeah, amazing results, because she started with introducing the concept via ways that students understand, which we talk a lot about accessing prior knowledge. And the other thing that I'm thinking too, as you're talking about time, is I recently went through this whole coaching thing. I made Trevor go through it as well. I had my career coach come on to one of our team meetings, who's just really contrast, a thought from an actual circumstance. And so I can't help, because I went through it in the last year. I hired her because I thought, I have two young kids. I was traveling like every 3 weeks. I was like, there's never enough time. And she was like, that's a thought response. That is not reality. And I was like, no, you don't understand. I travel all the time. I've got, and so anyway, I went through this and I told my best friend about it. She was like, that sounds like horse crap. Like there, I was like, no, you really have to just start telling yourself there is plenty of time. And you just like sort of flip your thoughts, and it worked. And so it's just sort of interesting that you bring up the idea of time. And because if we're talking about implementation, we're talking about teachers using their professional learning, you just made me think, oh gosh, we've got to like do a whole thing on time, on just like unpacking. We got to go through Trevor's whole cycle of unpacking the word time. Trevor, you need to go find some videos on YouTube. Mm-hmm. where we really just sort of unpack that. Sort of jumping back to some of your ideas that you put here, you chose a word that is somewhat like a bingo word. We yeah. might have our people, playing drinking games because you chose fidelity. And in staff meetings, they're like, oh God, if I hear the word fidelity. So I'm wondering if you could talk about that and what you mean by that.
Yeah, I when I wrote it down, I mean, when I submitted them, I was like, this one's probably gonna, it's a polarizing
ring
term.
Some bells, yeah.
It's a term when I was full-time in the classroom, I would roll my eyes, right? It's mm-hmm. And you're right, it's on the bingo card. It's on the, mm-hmm. the Zoom call bingo card. But for me, the fidelity, the word fidelity in this is, it's your fidelity to your students and it's your mm-hmm. fidelity to your program. And mm-hmm. and to start with the implement, so, now they all kind of blend together, but if we're going to implement something, there needs to be elements of fidelity. We need to implement our strategies and there needs to be a purpose behind why we would implement those mm-hmm. strategies. And so not to bypass that word for a sec, but we need to explicitly know what students' dispositions or unique dispositions and their past experiences, what they bring to the lesson, so we can implement those learning interventions with a level of fidelity. Mm-hmm. And it goes beyond the welcome mm-hmm. to grade 4 or welcome to grade 7. Please mm-hmm. fill out this business letter about yourself and what mm-hmm. did you do this mm-hmm. summer. It goes into what are you learning, or where are you coming from? What are the standards? What's the purpose of our learning? And mm-hmm. in Great Teaching by Design, we use Professor Hattie's skill, will, and thrill. So what is the skill, will, and thrill that students bring with them mm-hmm. to the lesson? And so it's this whole model is based on being true to the student and being true to the standards and not mm-hmm. getting wrapped up in the flavor of the week lesson that you could download mm-hmm. from a website, right? Mm-hmm. And that's kind of where the term fidelity comes in the sense that, and we go through in the discovery model, we go through very similar work to conceptual understanding. We unpack the standards, we draw mm-hmm. them into the concepts and the mm-hmm. verbs. Mm-hmm. And then from there, we layer on, what does my student already know about this? Right. So we can bypass. And that's probably for me been the most eye-opening aspect of this model that teachers oftentimes just will gloss over. They mm-hmm. don't want to engage in that initial understanding of what students know, because it will disrupt their teaching schedule. Mm-hmm. Right. I was always the teacher who had their unit plan done at the end of summer break, my unit mm-hmm. plan had already been done for the following. Mm-hmm. And I'm talking mm-hmm. semester, day by day. Mm-hmm. And then what mm-hmm. would happen by the third week of September, my mm-hmm. long-term plan was toast because, assemblies or fire drill right, or day off. So spending time understanding what the students bring to the lesson is such a great way to support future delivery of lessons. And it's, we can use the example of what you said in your tools for teaching conceptual understanding, where, you know, linking concepts to students' lives is also just an example of how we can discover what our students know.
That was a huge aha moment for me right when the pandemic started as a parent, because I have these two little kids who are above grade level and for certain things, but when they're very feisty, I have no idea where they get it from. their social emotional learning could use a little boost. And so it was just sort of like the school where I was sending them was so great at sort of differentiating and figuring out what, and so that's what I realized, oh man, parents have to be way more involved, because parents know, they know their kids and they know, you know, and so what we do now, I have this little routine with my first grader where when she says, okay, 10 minute independent reading time, he grabs his math workbook, because the kid is like 3 or 4 grade levels above in reading, but at grade level 4, his like mathematical facts. And so he knows like, that's what I need to be doing right now instead of the independent, because he reads like when he's off, that's what he does. He reads. And so we just made this little deal, and I talked to the teacher about it, and she was like, yeah, that seems like a good idea. So he just grabs his little math workbook that I bought him to work on that instead. And so I think that gets back to this concept of time that you said, and you mentioned this earlier, like it's almost like the teachers feel like I have to say it out of my mouth in order for kids to learn it. And it's, I'm also thinking of that TED talk of something about how, I can't remember the name of it, but how awful average is. Like it was a pilot who talked about, I don't know if you guys know this TED talk, but he talked about they design cockpits for the average, but nobody's the average. Like everybody's got like different, you know, so it ends up being a really bad cockpit for most people, because it's like nobody's quote unquote average.
That's right.
And so, you know, the idea that we teach to the average and we feel like every kid's the same and we have to preach by way of teaching. And so that's really nice that to you, fidelity is not necessarily to the thing. That's where I assumed you meant, like fidelity to conceptual understanding or whatever, but fidelity to the children and back to your learner focused one. That's really cool, Vince. That is like a new spin on the word fidelity. I love it.
Yeah. Yeah. I think it's, I probably should have put that down, because when you read that, you probably were like, oh no.
Fidelity to Professor Hattie's work. That's what I thought. That's what I like. You got to read the studies and make sure you do, but you know, and that there's some, of course, there's the reason why it's a buzzword is because there is some truth to that. You know, I love Doug Fisher and Nancy Fry's blog post about Jigsaw. And they start off, the first line is, will the real Jigsaw please stand up? Because the point is most of us, myself included, have been doing Jigsaw incorrectly. And so then you're not going to get the 1 point, whatever effect size that Jigsaw has, if you don't do it right. So there's some truth to that for sure, but I love the learner focused, and the fidelity to the students. That's awesome.
It's funny that it's funny that you mentioned the idea of Professor Hattie's work, because that's kind of where this all stemmed from. The idea for this book project stemmed from the fact that I was a big Professor Hattie nerd, in that I read the White Book, and you just kind of pick and choose the books that jump out, and sometimes it has nothing more than the way the cover looks, right? It's kind of like picking wine. Sometimes you just pick the bottle because you like the label. So when I was chatting with Ariel, you know, Julie, you put me in contact with Ariel. When I was chatting with Ariel, I was like, I love Professor Hattie's work, but I feel like there's no one singular entry point. And it would be nice if we could find a way to get people into the work, but also implementing it, right? Because, and that's one of Professor Hattie's main comments when he was criticized for his work, was that, well, all people were doing was taking his top 5 effect sizes and just repeating it, but they weren't implementing it with the fidelity that needed to happen. And so that's kind of where this whole kind of came from. So my apologies for cutting you off, Trevor.
Oh, no. Yeah, you're great. And I was just sort of thinking that pulling back those ideas of time, being learner focused and fidelity, teaching for conceptual understanding is one of the ways that I've have sort of found has been really helpful to do that. Because instead of treating students like an empty container into which we will dump our expertise and knowledge, we start looking for sluice ways between their lived experiences and things that they know and building and capitalizing on that. They have these inborn patterns and structures. And I think that's especially true now where students are consuming, I mean, maybe it is Minecraft or Marvel movies or Star Wars films or anime, but they come, especially in English language arts, filled to the brim with stories. And they have all these deeper, once you draw them out and tease them out, they have all these deeper patterns and structures that they begin to recognize. And when you really capitalize on those, I have found that time can be used more efficiently. Because you're building on a foundation that's already there, as opposed to trying to build the foundation and then pour the content knowledge on top of it. So I found your idea of sort of like that flipped mentality of exploring the concepts in class, but then having students go through the content themselves very interesting. I think that's something that I might explore a little bit in my own classroom from an English language arts perspective. So could you talk a little bit more maybe about some other ways that you can help teachers bring all those things together? You were just beginning to talk about implementation of Dr. Hattie's work. How does that sort of look through Great Teaching by Design?
Yeah, so I guess we've really gone through the discovery model, and that was my favorite part to write, just because I do feel quite passionately about taking time to really understand what students know before jumping into the intervention and implementation phase. But when we look at implementation, so we've discovered what our students know, and then we've chosen specific learning strategies based on effect size and also based on what students, their experiences and stuff, then we need to ensure that implementation happens at the most transparent level possible. So we start, very basically with, can the student reiterate the learning intention and the success criteria? Does the student know what they are learning and why they are learning it? Because if they do not, then everything comes to a screeching halt. And more recently, we've talked about this notion that learning becomes a checklist if students don't know what they're learning about. And I was a big video game player when I was younger, not anything too intense, but the first video game system we got was the original Nintendo. And I use that analogy all the time when we talk about like implementation and the fact that I would spend hours and weeks like literally running from left to right, because that's what you did on the TV screen. It just Super Mario just ran across and then he ran across. But I did it because I knew that there was a target I had to hit, and the game was giving me clues and markers of success, and I was excited about it. And you substitute that that analogy with any other video game, we want to take that excitement and make sure it's in the learning. And that doesn't happen if students don't know what the goals are. And there's a relevancy piece there. So there's that's very, very important. There also needs to be an appropriate environment for implementation. So a section in the book we specifically call quality delivery in an environment for implementation. We cannot ignore social emotional aspects. And we know right now that's more important than ever. For some of our students, the only social interaction they get with children of their similar age is on this call, on a Zoom call, on a Teams call. And so if we are not, as teachers, providing an opportunity just for students to interact at a social emotional level, that it's not going to take their learning further. That aspect of the environment is important. This idea of student teacher relationships are very important. And I know, Julie, you mentioned that before, like, sometimes we go to PDs and the PD presenter is like, you need to have better relationships with your students. And we're like, okay, I thought I was
always the best.
Yeah. No, I mean, it is true. There's a reason why those people are very popular, are in the public speaking circuit, because it's so true. And I think unfortunately for a lot of teachers, that is a wake up call, like, oh, crap, I guess I don't get to know my students. Probably I should do that. And I think it's harder for secondary teachers. I think secondary teachers are the ones who are usually like, oh, how in the world am I going to do that? I have 150 of them. And so, you know, I think that is things like that are, how do we give them efficient tools so that they can use time wisely to get to know those students? So, you know, one of the things, the recommendations I often make is pick the kids who need it the most. You know, like the track star or whatever maybe doesn't need you to like ask them how their day's going, but like the kid who's struggling probably really needs you to ask them how their day's going. And so I think, you know, teachers and somewhat how to use is this word of triage or diagnose. You know, you can say of my students, which ones do I think need my attention more than others? And instead of making it like treating the kids like this monolith, but treating the students like which of my kids really probably needs me to develop that relationship with them.
Yeah. And you know, that kind of started, I was very fortunate. I had like some fantastic mentorship when I first started teaching. And when I came out of university, I was a jock. I played post-secondary soccer. So all I knew was athletics. Not saying that I was like singular minded, but that was my passion. So what did I default to? I went to all the high school basketball games. I went to, you know, volleyball. I knew that I knew the jocks really well. And I connected with them on a different level in my class. And then an assistant principal at the time, who's still a good friend of mine, was like, you know what, you should probably just go to the play. Just go to the Christmas play. And if you hate it, this is what he said, really. He said, if you hate it, the kids will never know.
They don't care.
But they will know
they
that
saw you there. Absolutely.
Yeah.
And then what happened was I went to the play and I saw the, you know, the quiet students in the back in my class who never participated were like literally singing. It was a musical.
Yeah.
And I was floored. I was absolutely floored. And from then on, I went to every show possible because I didn't think I would enjoy it as much. I absolutely enjoyed it. And I, because of that, I think I became like one of my best friends, my best teacher colleague friends is a drama teacher. And so, and it's not because I'm just doing it out of the graciousness to see my students. It's because I've really valued rich student teacher relationships in the sense that I wanted to make an effort. I made the decision professionally to dedicate some of my time to learn more about each one of my students so that at the end of the semester, I could say, other than social studies, I know one thing each person is passionate about. And if I saw any of those students in the hallway looking a little bit upset, I could have that point of contact and I could pull them back in. And then they want to be in your class and then they're more engaged and then implementation is a little bit more successful.
I've also sort of found getting to know students' interests and passions as well, in addition to that very central like human relationship, social, emotional wellness piece, is it's helped me as a teacher too, because if a student is sort of struggling to connect with an idea or a concept and I know something that they're interested in or passionate about, I can sort of consider what sort of deeper structures or patterns are present in something they're interested in and how can I sort of connect that with their knowledge. And that's why, you know, I think about like the stereotypical, like, you know, using sports analogies like all the time. And that connects really well with athletes because they have their prior knowledge. And analogies and analogous thinking is something that is present in a whole lot of the learning transfer research. So it's that those same sort of premises apply if you are having connecting with a student with their love of Fortnite or their love of singing or dancing or acting. And you know, once you sort of are aware of those students' interests, it's really cool to create some connective tissue between things you're exploring in your class and things that they are passionate about in their lives. So they can see what potential affordances whatever class or course that you're teaching has to impact things that they are passionate about. And I think that creating some, I guess, synergy between all of those things not only leads for you to be a better mentor and connector with children, but also a better teacher too. And I think that all those things work together really beautifully. So I like the way that those all kind of came together.
Yeah, I love that. Thank you for sharing that story, because I know Trevor, I know personally that Trevor has some of those stories. I do as well, of you going to the play. And I imagine most people who are taking the time out to listen to us yammer on for an hour probably all have those stories. And so I think that's so great. You know, it's just such a nice way to remind us, you know, to reach out to those students, even if it's not our normal way that we connect. Mm-hmm. We don't have much time left, so I want to get to this last one. You talked about assessment / evaluation. I assume that means something similar to Fidelity. It means something slightly different than what our listeners might think you mean by that. But I'm not gonna assume. I'm gonna ask you. tell us about that word and why you're sort of picking / to articulate it.
Yeah. This could easily be a 7-part series.
You're right.
But in just a few minutes here, I think I'll talk about this. I feel like teachers in some cases, not all, and so don't hold it against me if this is not you, but there is a big misunderstanding between assessment, evaluation, and grading and marking. Mm-hmm. Those terms get juggled interchangeably.
Oh, yeah.
I have so much marking to do, right? And so... through the work that through this first book, I was asked by Doug Fisher and Nancy Fry, and I've heard you say this before, Julie, when Doug Fisher and Nancy Fry ask you to jump on a project, you don't say no. And so I jumped on. They had invited me to be a part of this assessment playbook because assessment is a huge passion of mine. And so I jumped on it. And through this work, we started talking about the difference between grading and assessment and evaluation, in that evaluation is continuous and evaluation consistently happens. And then assessment can be once in time, but multiple assessments make up an evaluation. So I'll use a portfolio as an example, because portfolios is something that I've been experimenting with, in that if you do multiple micro assessments across the semester, at the end you have a full evaluation of what a student learned, right? Mm-hmm. I'll use constructing a social studies essay so Trevor doesn't harp on me for not being but in Alberta, when students leave the 12th grade, they have to write standardized social studies exams, and there are two different writing assignments for social studies. And one of them is a multi-source analysis and then a relationship paragraph. That's the quickest way I can describe it. Instead of doing multiple different assignments, like one three-source assignment. And so I do, like, you know, traditionally I would give students over the course of a semester four assignment ones. I would just do one source at a time, give feedback, then do the second source, then do the third source. And from there, I can still gain enough information from what the student did in those minor assessments to make a proper evaluation of learning. And I feel like this idea of evaluation, oftentimes teachers don't feel like they know enough about the student, so they just rely on the percentage score. So there's a mix up between assessment and evaluation. So I'm going to give my kid a multiple choice exam, and then at the end of the semester, they got 80% on it, and that means they're an honors student. And then they leave. That's not an evaluation of student learning. That's one assessment about the student. Yeah. And so an evaluation is more robust. It's more timely. It involves, and this is also part of kind of the implementation piece, it involves being able to make mistakes and seek feedback on those mistakes. That's what we mean by evaluation. But oftentimes, evaluations are just multiple tests. So that's kind of where the intersection of both pieces of work that I've been kind of working on over the past year have kind of met, in that there's a system of evaluation, just like there's a system of instruction that can be practiced and implemented without the misunderstanding that one assessment determines what a student knows. As a matter of fact, since COVID has hit and we've moved to distance learning, I've toyed with the idea of just disbanding. Like, I would love to see no multiple choice. And I know some people who listen to this that might like shock them, but there are different ways to understand what students know, and then relying on your professional judgment, because all teachers are professionals, all teachers should be treated as professionals, and all teachers have the ability to create a professional judgment of learning if they have enough evidence. So you could disband this idea of assessments and just call them evidence of evaluation.
Yeah, assessments is, I mean, yeah, you're right. We need to have a whole other part. We'll have you on again to talk specifically longer about assessments, Bia, because there's so much to say about it. Mm-hmm. But I think you're spot on, and this is not new. I mean, Understanding by Design in 2005 was the second edition of Understanding by Design, and they talked about a snapshot versus a portfolio and how much better that is. You had Robert Marzano who came out and said, you know what, the average is the average out of 100 is kind of bull. But like, you know, this is not new, but it's clearly it's one of those things that just takes forever to get out of the sort of ingrained thinking, and maybe something that our previous podcast guest, we spoke about this, maybe will be accelerated with COVID. That might be somewhat of a silver lining that we accelerate the conversation about.
No, I was just going to say that and this bleeds into a conversation that listeners can hear next week with Dr. Jenny Chang-Walthall, is this notion that the very way that we conceive and think of knowledge has become really shaped by quantitative data points, and our ability to even conceptualize that there are other ways of knowing and other ways assessing knowledge is sort of, I guess our horizons have really shrunk just because we live in this very technocratic, data-driven culture and society. So I'm really excited to dig a little bit more into that and maybe on a part two episode. But if people want to read more of your work in the meantime, where would you recommend they go, and what would you recommend they check out?
Yeah, so you can access both books at Corwin, so corwin.com, same place you can find Julie's books and your upcoming book, which is very exciting, Trevor. I'm very excited for you. They're both on there. So the Great Teaching by Design is kind of where we've had most of our focus today on the discovery model. And then that second book is the Assessment Playbook for Distance and Blended Learning, which may be a little bit more significant at this current stage. At this moment, absolutely. I also kind of post, or you can access them through the link on my Twitter profile, which is just at Vince Busta, B-U-S-T-A.
Love it. Well, I think that we have got to get Great Teaching by Design and think about it. The whole time you were talking, I was thinking about, me as a trainer. I was thinking of it from that lens. So I'm excited to have access to you and your knowledge, and maybe we can talk more about implementation tools that we can provide as a team to our partner schools. That's a big thing on our minds right now. So thank you so much, Vince, for coming on, taking the time in this crazy situation everybody's in right now. It was so cool to talk with you.
Thank you, guys. Have a great day.
Thanks. You too. Thanks for tuning in to this episode of Conceptually Speaking. We hope you enjoyed the conversation and are coming away with a stronger grasp of the concepts and mental models that help us understand our world. If you like this podcast, feel free to like, comment, or subscribe on your favorite platform. If you want to learn more or get involved, check out our website at edtosavetheworld.com and join our Facebook group, Learning That Transfers.